WOSU Public Media podcasts are made possible thanks to listener support. All of our digital content, such as Snully Goster and the All Sides of the Ann Fisher podcast, depend on the generosity of listeners like you. You can give at WOSU.org or through the WOSU mobile app. And thanks.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Six of the eight people killed last week in Atlanta were of Asian descent, six women. Authorities say the shooter denied his actions were racially motivated, but for many Asian American and Pacific Islanders, the killings were the latest in a painful year of increased anti-Asian violence and hate in the COVID era. President Biden spoke after meeting with Asian American leaders in Atlanta on Friday.
Hate and violence often hide in plain sight. It's often met with silence. That's been true throughout our history. But that has to change, because our silence is complicity. We cannot be complicit.
Wall Street Journal reporter Cameron McWhorter is based in Atlanta, where he's been following the story. Welcome to the show, Cameron.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
What do we know so far about the shooter, 21-year-old Robert Allen Long?
Robert Aaron Long was a troubled, apparently a very troubled man who had a what he described to police as a sexual addiction, and he has been wrestling with that for many years. And eventually, last week, he purchased a gun and went and shot several massage parlors that he's told law enforcement that he visited several times. Obviously a tragic and horrendous act of violence that has that definitely shocked Atlanta. But, you know, roiled in all of this was a much more complicated issue, which is he attacked massage parlors, whatever you want to call them, that were where there were a lot of Asian women working there. And six, as you pointed out, six of the eight people killed were Asian of Asian descent, and they were women.
What do we know about the victims besides their ethnicity? Were they people that actually had worked with him?
That is unclear as to whether he had actually hired them for sex acts, but it is clear that he did frequent those places. It also we're trying to build a picture of who these victims were, and at least some of them had very minor brushes with the law, misdemeanor brushes with the law regarding the, you know, massage, inappropriate acts, sex acts.
Right. The authorities had Robert Aaron Long in custody within hours of the shootings. And they were quick to offer a motive, which I thought was interesting. What did you think of that?
Well, this I think your point, you're getting to the whole crux of this entire thing and the why we're having national discussions about all this. You know, as I've covered a lot of crime in my day, as a lot of reporters have. And for the police to capture someone that quickly was astounding. And then for the Cherokee County Sheriff's Office to offer a motive was what I was fixated on. I was, oh my gosh, they're giving us a motive already. That's amazing. Then, as everyone will recall, a spokesman for the office said, made his remark about a bad day. And frankly, I'm a white man, and I heard that, but at the tail end of, and in my brain, the whole thing I'm processing is, oh my gosh, they gave us a motive. And I get out and I start talking to my editors and start talking to other reporters, and it becomes, and then the Asian community just rebelled and just reacted to that in such a visceral way that I realized, oh, okay, this is a completely different story now. We are Asian Americans have been living in this claustrophobic situation for generations, perhaps, but certainly it's elevated in the last year or so. And now this is just the final straw. And so that's why you saw protests over the weekend and why people are saying this has raised all kinds of issues regarding how Asian Americans are treated. But it's very complicated because it's also how women are treated, how gender plays a role in our in the broader society, and how gender plays a role in Asian society. The economic strata, these women were all struggling at the lower strata of Asian American society, and Asian Americans have this myth that lots of Asian Americans have been talking about recently, this whole myth of the model minority, and they're rebelling against that. They're saying that's simplistic, it's archaic, it's not accurate, and Americans need to re-examine their relationship with the Asian American community.
Like so many others.
Yeah.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Wall Street Journal reporter Cameron McWhorter, based in Atlanta, covering the shootings last week of eight people at massage parlors in the Atlanta area, and six of the victims are Asian descent women. And he's just been talking about, you know, kind of the fetishization of Asian women is one way to look at it. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. We're talking about this all hour. We'll be getting into the, you know, the backstories, of course, with scholars later on. So 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Online petitions are circulating calling for the firing of that spokesperson, Jay Baker, of the Cherokee County Sheriff's Office, who said he was having a bad day and was at the end of his rope with a sex addiction. That seemed to be something that kind of really made people's heads explode all over the place. Just the idea that that's an explanation for anything.
Well, and I'm not gonna, you know, I mean, Mr. Baker's motivations were for saying what he said, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I sort of err on the side of forgiveness on making public remarks. That being said, it clearly triggered among Asian Americans a sense that they're being this horrendous act was somewhat being dismissed as, and now, and this is what we're all certainly in Atlanta and perhaps around the country are wrestling with. You know, all the facts do point to him having a real struggling situation with sex addiction, this shooter, but that doesn't erase the fact that he was shooting at eight women who were Asian American. So it doesn't, the two things don't cancel each other out. And it's become this giant, as my email box can testify, it's become this cultural debate that's gone far beyond the horror of what happened.
What has caught your eye in that debate in your mailbox? What have you learned from that?
I'm sure you do this every day on your job, but I mean, this country is a very divided nation, and the partisan politics bubble up in every issue. So here we have, you know, eight people are dead, and the Asian American women who were killed were struggling, hardworking. A lot of them had children, and those children are now orphaned. And this is all kind of being lost in this general debate over, well, it was a sex addiction. No, it was racism. It was sex addiction. It was racism. Both things can be true. And that's a complicated thing to untangle.
All right. So then prosecuting hate crimes is difficult as well. We found that over the last, 10 to 20 years since they started to emerge as specifications in crime laws. There's a high bar for proving the motive, right? I mean, it's not.
Right. That's going to be that. So the Cherokee County Sheriff's Office offered up their version of events and from their interrogation of the shooter. And he confessed to the crimes. So, but the Atlanta Police Department, where two of the shootings took place, the Atlanta Police Department is still investigating very carefully whether hate crime was a part of this. To some extent, this is all pretty academic. He killed eight people with, he's met the requirement for prosecutors to seek the death penalty. Mm-hmm. And whether they will seek it or not is something there, I assume they're calculating. But this guy's going away forever.
But the people who want to identify the motive clearly, there's an imperative for that, that for them, that it the hate issue is important.
Certainly, and you're seeing the Atlanta Police Department was very quick the next day after the Cherokee sheriff's remarks, sheriff's spokesman's remarks, yeah. To say, look, we're still investigating this. This is a fresh crime, and we are looking very carefully at whether hate was a motive, whether this and these laws were recently passed here in Georgia. We did not have the current law that we currently, it is just come into play, and that was because of the shooting last year in on the coast. Mr. Arbery's was killed, and that was clearly racially motivated.
Tell us about the Asian American and community in Atlanta. Is it large? Is it prominent?
Yes. Okay. The Asian American community in Atlanta, Atlanta itself is a very growing city.
Right.
We're a major draw from places like Ohio, and we have a huge Asian community, a huge Korean American community that has been growing and is generally perceived as extremely prosperous. And one of the things that and other Asian groups, of course, we have a lot of people from India or India descended people. We have a lot of people from China, and so that is all. They've all been doing very well, and that's perception, is that everyone's doing very well. What this has exposed is that there are a lot of Asian Americans who are struggling economically and are on the lower rungs of the ladder we're all trying to climb. And this has awakened that consciousness for Americans in general, but also for people within the Asian American community. So when I went to rallies this weekend, there were a lot of investment analysts, mortgage brokers, you know, people who are by any definition of American society would be successful. And they were out there and they said, that's because we can't take this anymore. People being, you know, I talked to one man who said he was a mortgage broker and his sons, he had worked hard. He'd been in the United States for 30 years. He had worked hard to get his sons a good education. They both attended Harvard. And he said they, in the last year, had racial slurs thrown at them, told back to go back to China, things like that. So that is really where there's a lot of frustration over that.
The role of the former President Trump in all of this, has that been come into play at all? His, you know, the Kung Flu and the Chinese virus and all of his references to that. To that effect?
That came up, and certainly people were discussing that with us. I mean, to what extent that has played a role. Certainly the perception among the Asian American community is that played a huge role. A lot of the people I interviewed brought that up, that very point. Now, we mentioned that people had brought that up in a story we wrote over the weekend. And again, I got a lot of emails
from
very angry about that.
Complaining that you're picking on Trump or something?
Yes, correct. Why are you bringing him into this issue? And the only reason we did was because people mentioned it. I mean, it was because people were talking about it.
Cameron McWhorter, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
That was great talking to you. Thanks.
Yeah, take
thanks
care. Good luck. Cameron McWhorter is an Atlanta-based reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's been covering the story of the shootings last week at a couple of massage parlors in the Atlanta area. We will continue our conversation. If questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And certainly, if you're among our listeners, if you're of Asian descent, Asian American, and have your own stories to tell, Obviously, we want to hear from you, so give us a call, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Atlanta area killings last week of eight people, including six women of Asian descent, have unleashed a wave of demonstrations across the country as mourners took a stand against anti-Asian violence and hate. Abby Bogard and Sam Shim, a member of the Worthington City Schools Board of Education, spoke with 10 TV News at a Columbus rally on Saturday.
We've been harassed, we've been intimidated, we've been attacked over the past year. There's been hateful rhetoric, such as the China virus, directed at us.
We're tired of being quiet. We're tired of going through this hurt between all of us, and we want change.
Silence is no longer an option.
State Senator Tina Maharath, a Democrat who represents the 3rd Senate District, kind of wraps around Columbus from Westerville to the Hilltop, also attended the rally. She co-sponsored a bill that would create a state commission and state office for Asian American and Pacific Islander Affairs. Welcome to the show, Senator.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
Washington Post reporter Michelle Yehi is president of the Asian American Journalist Association, representing more than 1,700 journalists across the U.S. and in Asia. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Professor Melissa Borja is a faculty member in the Asian Pacific Islander American Studies program at the University of Michigan. She's been studying anti-Asian racism during the COVID-19 pandemic. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you.
Professor Borja, you are affiliated with the nonprofit group Stop AAPI Hate, which has logged nearly 3,800 incidents of hate against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in the past year. I mean, can you put that number into some context for us about the curve of this and how fast it occurred?
Well, Stop AAPI Hate began gathering information about anti-Asian harassment incidents in March 2020 in response to all of the stories we heard from families and friends, as well as stories reported in news media of anti-Asian racism. Now, we don't have data before 2020, but we do know other researchers have found that there had been a documented 10-year-long downward trend in anti-Asian bias, which was reversed in the first week of March with the pandemic and with some politicians insisting on using stigmatizing rhetoric that associates Asian people with the coronavirus.
Right. The Kung flu and the China virus and that kind of a thing, right? It was straight from the lips of former President Trump.
Correct. And I think it's also important to remember he was not the only one who has used those terms. We're seeing politicians and everyday people use that language at all levels of government. In Michigan, the state Senate majority leader used stigmatizing rhetoric like that, too. So he's not the only one. And we need to remember that we all have a part to play in talking about the COVID-19 pandemic in a way that's responsible to all people, especially Asian Americans who are vulnerable at this time.
And then there's the issue. I think it was the young woman that was quoted, Abby Bogard, saying that we're not going to be silent anymore. We have to speak out. What about that trope about quiet, reserved, not making any waves kind of a thing and how that plays into this?
That is a longstanding stereotype of Asian American people. And unfortunately, that has perhaps caused some Asian American people, especially Asian American women, to be targeted in acts of harassment and violence. But the reality is Asian Americans have been calling out for racial justice for as long as they have been in the United States, since the 19th century. So the idea that Asian American people, especially Asian American women, are silent and submissive is simply not rooted in the truth. And if anything, Asian Americans are leaning into this moment and finding their power and asserting their agency more than ever before. And there is a deep history to that.
And I want to talk about that. But, you know, Michelle Lee, how we cover this as journalists is really critical. And I'm so glad you could join us today, because just right off the bat, I mean, I don't know. I mean, in a way, I feel like I should have been talking about this last year when, you know, obviously before as a journalist, it would have been due diligence. But there was, it got lost in the shuffle, I think, the references. What are you telling journalists about how to cover this moment and how, and going forward, what are the issues that journalists need to know about how to cover it?
Right. We have been raising awareness about rhetoric and violence aimed at Asians, Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders during this moment for a year. Our first guidance on this came out actually on how to cover COVID and Asians came out in February 2020. And since then, we've been raising awareness and urging newsrooms to cover it. But, you know, still Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders are still very underrepresented in the news industry, and particularly in news leadership. So the higher you go up in the management chain where people make editorial decisions, make decisions on how to shape coverage, how to direct coverage, AAPIs are very much underrepresented. And it's become increasingly clear that people in those management positions do not know the experience of AAPIs in this country, have not taken the time to learn about the history and experience, because if they did know, then we would not have seen the type of coverage we saw immediately about the Atlanta shooting. When the police had a press conference and said that the shooter told them that the shooting was not racially motivated and that he just had a really bad day with his sex addiction, we saw too many newsrooms quote the police just verbatim, took the shooter's word that this was not racially motivated. If we had enough managers and executives who were well-versed in the history and experience of AAPIs in this country, especially AAPI women, they would have immediately known that racism goes hand in hand with sexualization, sexual violence of Asian women. So immediately AAJA came out with the guidance explaining this and urging newsrooms to take care of their coverage. And we thankfully saw language change, but I'm afraid that at that point, that narrative had taken off.
Right. I mean, Cameron McWhirter of the Wall Street Journal said, oh, there's a motive already. I mean, that was the big surprise that they had come up with a motive and kind of took it. And he admitted, yeah, it was just kind of, it didn't occur to him. White male. I just self-identified as a white male. It was kind of interesting. And then, of course, then the blowback came and he was grateful for it. But what kind of feedback are you getting, Michelle Lee, from journalists across the country? What are they telling you about what they're learning about this?
Well, I can tell you that immediately after we put out the guidance, there was so much demand for it that it crashed our website for the first time in a decade.
The irony of it.
So
yeah.
We had to rush to get it back up in different formats. We put out like screenshots and a Google Doc and everything because it was clear people needed this guidance. It was clear they were not getting enough of it, whether it's because the AAPIs in their newsrooms are too lower ranking to really be heard, whether they're not paying attention to those employees, or they just didn't think about it. So, you know, and we're also hearing from our journalists, especially the ones who are the only Asian in their newsroom, that they feel so burdened to represent all Asians in this moment, that they feel like they have to correct the course of their newsroom on their own. And we're trying to take that burden off of those individuals and also raise awareness about the burden they feel. And we're hearing from journalists still that their newsrooms are slow to pay attention to their feedback. So it's clear to us that we need to continue to be loud about this. Speaking again to this trope that Asians are quiet, AAJA needs to keep speaking up on behalf of our journalists and our community to make sure that the news coverage is accurate, is comprehensive, and takes in the totality of the Asian American experience.
And does it over and over and over again until it becomes rote and not some kind of performance. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That is Washington Post reporter Michelle Yeh Healy. She is the president of the Asian American Journalists Association. It represents 1,700 journalists across the U.S. and in Asia. Also with us, you heard Professor Melissa Borja of the Asian Pacific Islander American Studies Program at the University of Michigan. And joining us as well, State Senator Tina Maharath. She represents Ohio's 3rd Senate District. She is the first Asian American woman elected to the Ohio Senate. I guess I looked at you when Michelle said the pressure of being representative of an entire, you know, group of millions of people, Senator Maharath. But you don't you don't shy away from it. I mean, you are a co-sponsor, as I said, of legislation that would create a state commission and state office for Asian American Pacific Islander affairs. What is the evidence that something like that's needed? How are you selling that to your fellow lawmakers?
Yes, so with the creation of the commission, I advocated because, well, both of us, so the joint sponsor is on the other side of the aisle. It's a Republican. Mm-hmm. He is actually of Indian, of Asian descent, and he's also an immigrant. I'm a refugee. So what I try to sell it to the majority is that this should not be controversial. It's us. It's up to us as a legislator to set an example for Ohioans. So by creating this commission, I want them to understand the unique difficulties of addressing the needs of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders here in Ohio, so that formation of this commission will create that important step in ensuring that state government is accessible and equitable to all of us Ohioans. But the problem is we have to address the fact that we're here, we exist, we're the only ethnicity without that, without any commission right now.
We're only the only what?
Ethnicity without
ethnicity,
a commission.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. And by the way, having three people on at the same time, we're going to be on for the rest of the hour. It's a lot. So I invite you to kind of jump in and converse with each other. Don't wait for my Q&A thing going on. Professor Borja, how big of a deal is it to study these things and not and you're doing it at an academic level. Senator Maharath is thinking about it at a more, you know, policy minded level.
Well, I'm an academic whose work relates directly to community organizations. I think that's an important dimension you need to understand about Stop AAPI Hate, that we're researchers working with community organizations and we're also informing public policy. So to relate to what Senator Maharath just said, later this week, I'm talking to the Michigan Asian Pacific American Affairs Commission. We have an advisory commission in Michigan to serve Asian Americans, and they have been critical to making sure Asian Americans are safe in this moment and safe in the long term. My father actually served on this commission almost two decades ago. So one thing we are seeing is that the existence of institutions like this at the city level, at the state level, has a really positive impact on helping Asian Americans in this moment and in long term. And so we're studying how not just these instances of racism are affecting Asian Americans, but what are useful ways Asian Americans and allies of Asian Americans can work together to make safe and inclusive communities for all.
Can you give me an example of how the commission and having an existing such commission in Michigan has made a difference?
One thing we know is that Asian Americans, compared to other racial minorities in the United States, are still a relatively small and misunderstood community. So one thing these commissions do is help elected officials understand what these communities need. And there can be a big disjuncture between the experiences Asian American communities have on the ground and what elected officials understand to be their needs. And so we can see these institutions as helping elected officials know how to get the support and resources that exist to the people who would benefit from them and to know that those support and resources exist. So that's one big effort now. The other thing that is useful about these commissions is it gives Asian Americans a sense of political efficacy. When they know that there are people in their government who are like them, who understand their experiences, it does make Asian Americans, I think, look at government as an expression in a way of making change. And I think that's good for fostering democratic participation in America.
Let's see, turn to Randy in Delaware. You're on the air. Hi, Randy.
Hi, just wanted to ask about the idea that systemic racism itself is kind of exemplified in the fact that we can claim lack of intention or ignorance. And I just will take my answer off the air and wanted to see what your guest had to say about it. Thank you.
Okay, Randy, I just want to make sure I get you straight, that you're saying that systemic racism, the how it's entrenched and kind of everything is lets us get off the hook.
Right. I mean, you know, we can just claim lack of intention or ignorance.
Yeah, okay. Okay. So, you know, Michelle Lee, I turn to you on this point because that kind of explains this. Well, they gave a motive, and so that's what the motive is, and walk away and go do your report, right?
Right. I think what this experience showed us as journalists, especially journalists at AHA who are trying to hold newsrooms to a higher standard of reporting on this, is that we are still, as an industry, too dependent on the police narrative to be the defining one. And I think we've seen over the past year, around the racial justice protests, the social justice movements in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd, that we should not take police at their word, and that we as journalists should ask more questions, inquire more, investigate the issue more before we just, you know, parrot the police narrative. But it's become clear to us that we have not fully been trained to do that in every instance that affects different communities. And we are clearly not equipped to do that well when it comes to API communities. So I would say that, you know, the systemic issues that we see in the way that our institutions interact really came to the foreground in this instance. Mm.
Senator Maharath?
Yes, so I definitely do want to weigh in, because the systemic racism is something that we've been dealing with historically for decades, way before any of us on this call today were even born. And that's why it is up to us legislators to make that change, because we have to start by at least doing the bare minimum here in the state of declaring racism as a public health crisis, because discrimination will not be tolerated anywhere in the state, and we shouldn't stay silent on this issue. But that's the thing, though. These are cries for help that we've been making for decades. This isn't something that just popped up all of a sudden. Me as a refugee, I differ as an immigrant. So I didn't go through the same experience in life as somebody who came here as an immigrant. And that's why it is important for us policymakers to be aware of those many differences present in our AAPI population. We differ in culture, languages, religions, and socioeconomic status. For example, I'm 30 years old and I've been in and out of foster care. I've been homeless before. I'm a single mother and I had to struggle just to become a state senator. But if you were to look at my Caucasian counterpart, possibly a woman as well, she probably has never even been inside a foster home before. Or someone like my counterpart for this piece of legislation, he and I have both been victims of child abuse growing up. But he has no idea how it feels to be homeless because his father was a doctor. It's those type of situations that us policymakers need to be very well aware of. But it's also something that we need to talk about, because this form of hate, the AAPI hate, ever since the uptick with the pandemic has happened, the uptick in racism and hate crimes against Asian Americans create this atmosphere for us here in Ohio that there's no safe place for us here. And that should be the complete opposite. This should be a safe place for us. There should be no a place for hate or any kind of discrimination here in Ohio. This is my home. I was born and raised here. I'm an Asian American. But people here, I think Michelle does make a good point that the media sometimes make it seem like we are second class citizens and we are just right there at the bottom, just as everybody else. But historically, the system has been deterred away from any person of color, essentially here in the state of Ohio as well.
Well, I mean, it sounds like when I talked here, you know, Michelle Lee, when you describe the task before us is to question everything and to get out of our own skins and do it. And that's a lot. And it's worth it, but it's a lot. And I think that it's the way I've learned about things is through history. And I'm really interested in talking about that historical backdrop to all of this and you know, what we've learned over the years and what we know about where this comes from. But it just feels like the whole country's pretty bigoted. If you're not white, mainstream, middle class, picked yourself up by the bootstraps, then there's a challenge there. For anyone. We will return. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last week, eight people, including six women of Asian descent, were shot and killed by a gunman who later claimed he was trying to eliminate the temptations of his sex addiction. Evidence that violence and hate directed at Asians, Asian Americans, and Pacific Islanders has increased exponentially during the pandemic. We're talking about that today. Still with us is State Senator Tina Maharath. She represents the 3rd Senate District. It kind of wraps around from Westerville to the Hilltop, one of those crazy districts. She is co-sponsor of a measure that would create a state commission and state office for Asian and American and Pacific Islander affairs. Also with us, Washington Post reporter Michelle Yeh Healy. She's president of the Asian American Journalists Association with 1,700 members across the U.S. and in Asia. And Professor Melissa Borja. She's of the Asian Pacific Islander American Studies Program at the University of Michigan, where she's been studying anti-Asian racism during the COVID-19 pandemic. Professor Borja, what about the stereotype? Well, let's first of all, I wanted to ask you about kind of the history, you know, where this comes from and what this historical backdrop is to all of this.
I think the killings in Atlanta were the convergence of two longstanding trends in the United States and honestly around the world: violence against women and violence against Asian people. And there is a very deep history of anti-Asian violence in the United States. We can go back to the 19th century when we saw the massacre of Chinese immigrants in California. We can think about the massacre of Filipino people in the Philippine-American War. We can think about also what happened the year I was born. I always say I was born the season Vincent Chin was killed. I was born in 1982 in Michigan, and Chinese American man named Vincent Chin was killed during a period of anti-Asian hostility in the context of rising tensions between the US and Japanese automakers. So this is not new. And I think one thing that is very concerning to me is that the idea that Asian Americans exist, number one, and the idea that Asian Americans experience racism, that those two ideas might be new to a lot of Americans, reveals to me that we really need to rethink how we're teaching American history. The reality is Asian Americans have been here a long time, and Asian American history is American history.
I mean, most people, it's as one-dimensional is they helped build the transatlantic railway.
Yeah, we know a few things. We know that they built the railroad. Maybe some kids learn about Japanese incarceration. I have a school-aged child. I don't know if she has learned that yet. I'm a little bit concerned. I know I didn't learn about that when I was a child. But I think we need to continue to see Asian American experiences as not apart from American history, but very much intertwined, and not just Asian Americans as contributing to America, which we have, but also as being subjected to exclusion, restriction, racism. I think it's really striking that a lot of people don't know that Asian Americans were not able to become citizens because of their race until a few decades ago, that my marriage, I'm married to a white man, would have been illegal in some places decades ago. And so that's new information to people, and we need to teach that history.
So many parallels with the African-American community, too, Michelle Lee. I mean, when you talk about covering and reporting and the journalism of covering this, are there parallels there?
Well, yeah, I think there's parallel in that we need to take care to put these experiences into context. Like Melissa said, you know, I think the challenge is that not enough newsrooms are well-equipped to talk about this, because maybe they don't even know the history. They don't even know where to turn to for the history or the experts. So I think one of the challenges moving forward as journalists, regardless of your background, and in fact, you should be covering Asian issues, even if you're not Asian. Mm-hmm. Shoulder this burden with us, because it should not only be up to the Asian in the newsroom. I think the challenge moving forward will be how newsrooms can continue to this conversation forward, that we don't just treat this as a one-off crisis that will go away, you know, in 6 months or a year, but how newsrooms can responsibly move forward and continue to educate our readers, our listeners, audiences about this history. And one of the ways to do that is to really cultivate sources and experts as journalists who come from these specialty areas. And that's one of the things that AAJ does. We have a website called AAJ Studio, where we make sure that newsrooms don't have an excuse not to quote someone who's Asian on any matter, whether it's tax law or healthcare or civil rights or Asian American issues. We want to make sure that AAPIs are heard. So I think moving forward, newsrooms definitely need to be bringing this sort of context, finding the right experts, and moving the conversation forward about how we can all continue to learn more.
I mean, I wouldn't write a sports analogy without picking up the phone and calling a sports writer to make sure I'm getting it straight. It's the same idea, right?
Right. We tend to approach this as like some topic that we don't know even how to talk about, because if we're not Asian, then we can't talk about this or even know about this. But at the end of the day, it just comes down to asking questions and learning, which is something that we all can do. And it's not some unique expert area that anyone who's not Asian American, you know, is not equipped to learn about. All it takes is to find the right person and just ask questions and try to learn.
Senator Maharath, are you getting a lot of calls these days?
Yeah, well, in terms of media, not really, to be honest. I think it's because of the intimidation of not having a lot of coverage or a lot of information or historical data about Asian American and Pacific Islanders. Because I did introduce a resolution this GA to denounce the discrimination against Asian Americans, but I also introduced it last year at the height of the Asian American hate crimes. I did have last General Assembly, I did have one journalist reach out, and she asked me if I had any numbers for specifically in Ohio of how many hate crimes were reported. And unfortunately, we didn't have that information available. And it's not that it wasn't happening. It was just the fact that we didn't have people who wanted to report those crimes because they're intimidated. They don't have the platform, or they didn't have the level of comfort to try to reach out to their local law enforcement, because again, with the problems within our system, they didn't feel comfortable enough, or they didn't feel confident enough that their concerns were even going to be taken serious. And that's why it's important to have this commission, because this commission would gather whatever data we have and disseminate that information that concerns the AAPI community. And it'll stimulate all these public awareness and advocacy of the AAPI community through education. But we're going to do that with partnership, though, by coordinating and assisting and providing assistance from other public and private organizations that specifically serve the AAPI community. But we can't do that unless we start with that number one discussion of who are we? Who is the AAPI community? What is the AAPI community? Because I did get a lot of calls about what does AAPI stand for? And that was before Georgia happened. So I'm disappointed and disheartened to hear that it took a mass shooting for us to get any public awareness here in the state. But now it definitely opens up the discussion, and it opens up the door of the severity of the discrimination that we are being faced with here in Ohio.
Tom and Gehanna, you're on the air. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Ann. Thank you for having this show. At my age, I grew up in the 1950s with a lot of World War II veterans. And they usually refer to the Japanese by a derogatory term. Of course, we had the roundup of the Japanese Americans. Interestingly, about 30 years ago, I was in a local museum in Monterey, California. And right after Pearl Harbor, they rounded up Japanese Americans and also Italian Americans, who we eventually, a few days later, went to war against. And a few weeks later, they released it to the Italians, which was interesting to me. Now, my question is now, the Japanese-American conflict had some economic issues involved with oil and rubber, and I'm wondering now with the economic fight with China, if this is part of something that may eventually lead to a greater hatred of the Chinese, Asians, and eventually armed conflict. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Wow. Okay. Thanks, Tom. Professor Borja, there's a lot in that package. It's not just about the COVID-19 in this past year. There's also been this big thing, or was this big, I don't know what you want to call it, one-upsmanship between the former president and China.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I'll be perfectly honest. I started this research a year ago and had been naive in my assumption that when the pandemic's end is in sight, and I think we're seeing the end in sight with vaccines more widely available and cases going down, I'd assumed that cases of anti-Asian racism and violence would decrease, but that hasn't happened. It's actually surged at a moment when I really didn't expect it to, which indicates to me two things. First, the pandemic and the racialization associated with it will have a long tail. And number two, the framing is bigger than just the pandemic. We know historically that in circumstances of geopolitical tensions between the US and Asia, Asian Americans have been vulnerable. World War II is an example of that. And we need to be aware that rising tensions between the US and China is going to be a context in which Asian Americans can continue to be more vulnerable moving forward, which is why it is so essential that we don't just respond to pandemic-related racism, but that we actively build institutions that help keep Asian Americans safe at the city and state and national level, like the commission that Senator Mahaerath is advocating.
Is a commission like that, Michelle Lee, in your experience, like what Senator Mahaerath is working on, is that unusual in states, or do most states have something like that?
Well, I haven't looked into that specifically, but I can tell you that usually commissions or groups that are specifically focused on APIs are usually one of the last groups to be created in terms of the racial representative groups. It's the same way in even companies where employee resource groups and employee support groups, the API ones are often the last ones to be thought of and have to be created among the Asians themselves rather than from the company. I think overall, what we're getting at is a broad systemic overlooking of Asian Americans in many different sectors of this country, whether it's media or government or public service or companies. And I think that is what we're trying to raise awareness about, that it's just no longer okay to be overlooked. And we're tired of it. And that whether you're a politician or a journalist or a historian, we all can play the same part in becoming louder for the community.
So, Professor Borja, what's next in this? I think probably it's a journey that's, as you said, it has a long tail now, a much longer tail than we might have anticipated.
I'm a historian by training, so I wish I could predict the future. But one thing.
But what does history teach us? I guess is the question.
I think if I look back at these moments where Asian Americans have suffered, and where Asian Americans also are calling for justice, these are watershed moments where we can make, in the context of our trauma, take advantage of the opportunity for transformation. And so I'm seeing all sorts of calls for change that affect all sorts of populations that are being affected. I'm seeing calls for policies to address racist bullying that's really affected Asian American youth. Yeah. I'm seeing calls for increased education about Asian American experiences in K-12 education. I'm seeing the creation of institutions within religious communities to be responsive to the pastoral needs of Asian American people of faith. I'm seeing all sorts of ways that institutions are responding to the needs of their Asian American members. And I think that's very encouraging. And I think we need to remember that we can respond to this pain in a variety of ways that are productive and forward-looking. And that's really the opportunity we need to seize right now.
Yeah. Senator Mahaerath, I'll let you have the last word. And just where do you direct people who are looking for, you know, a way to survive the transformation as it stands at this point? Where should people go in Ohio?
Here in Ohio, when it comes down to this transformation, I advocate for them to reach out to their state senator directly and advocate for a hearing for my piece of legislation. So we have been advocating amongst social media, at least, to contact Chair Rogner to have a hearing on this piece of legislation, because this is going to be a step forward, and it's going to be an important step forward of healing. It's going to promote the delivery of their state services that we have to offer across diverse communities, just not to the Caucasian communities. And it helps us provide resources for culturally appropriate organizations and language services. Because the fact of the matter is, Asian Americans have existed here in Ohio long before I was even born, long before my family even made it here in this country. And we shouldn't have them live in fear because of their color of their skin. Any minority here in the state of Ohio, they shouldn't feel unsafe here as a result of the pandemic or as a result of these hate crimes. This is their home. And I think it starts with calling your state senator and telling them, hey, can we get this commission passed? This will provide us with a sense of unity, and it'll provide us with a sense of healing and the next steps forward to see a hope and a new light. And it sheds some transparency about how far are we.
Senator, I'm sorry, I hate to interrupt you, but I have to cut you off. State Senator Tina Maharath represents Ohio's 3rd Senate District. Thanks for your time. Washington Post reporter Michelle Yehee Lee, president of the Asian American Journalists Association, and Professor Melissa Borja at the University of Michigan. Thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.